There we go. All right, good to see everybody tonight.
Good evening.
Is this on? Is it on? Is it working?
That's no. On. That's on.
There we go. Okay. I will tell you, I gave you a 4-page handout. I think everybody got one. And the text that we're going to look at tonight, most of it is in there. But if you want to follow along in your own Bibles, we're going to be primarily Matthew 23 and 24. I'll probably talk a little bit about 25, but I'm mostly going to focus on 23 and 24. We'll spend most of our time on 24. And as I said this morning, I just saw this as an opportunity because there's a lot of material here where I knew tonight I wasn't going to do a why should I believe lesson because I figured we have a smaller crowd. And I've tried really hard in this 1 Peter series because Peter was one of the 12. I've tried really hard to show that, you know, that what Peter is presenting to these Christians in Galatia, he learned it from Jesus. And I think when you look at interpreting what Peter said, when there's questions about what does this mean, I think it's a beneficial to look at and go, well, did Jesus teach something similar? And so when I looked at, you know, how do we interpret when Peter says the end of time, you know, the end of all things is at hand, what did he learn from Jesus? You know, as soon as we got in the car, Sarah said, well, Daddy, you said that none of the commentaries agreed with you. Well, what did they think it meant? And there were really two schools of thought in the various commentaries. By far, the most predominant school of thought was, well, that Peter misunderstood Jesus. And he thought Jesus was going to come back soon, but he was mistaken. Well, you could say, well, the end result is the same, that he still was trying to communicate a sense of urgency. But I don't personally think Peter was mistaken. I don't think Peter was mistaken. I think Peter understood when Jesus said, I don't know when I'm coming back, that he didn't know when he was coming back. That was by far the most prevalent kind of commentary on that. The other side was that those who tried to interpret it as not the end of the world and Jesus returning, but the end of the Jewish system or the end of the Mosaic law in terms of temple worship, that was going to come to an end. But I looked at that and thought, if he was writing to a Jewish audience, you know, maybe I would understand if that was what he meant by the end of all things, but writing to a Gentile audience in Galatia, I have a hard time believing that that's what he meant. And so, I went back and asked myself the question, what did, much like back in chapter 2 of 1 Peter, you know, Peter was talking about metaphors about growing, right? And one of those metaphors about growing was talking about Jesus being the cornerstone. And he quotes from the prophets and saying, you know, you can stumble over the stone, but you can also do what? You can build your life on this stone. Well, Peter in Caesarea Philippi was asked, well, who do you say that I am? He says, you're Christ, the Son of the living God. And he says, you are Peter, play on words, the rock. You are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church. He told Peter, I'm building my church on what you just said came out of your mouth. That I'm the Son of God. And Peter, reflecting that in 1 Peter 2, reflects that. Says, hey, you've got this, he's the chief cornerstone. That's where you build your life. Well, who told him that? Jesus told him that. And so when the disciples asked Jesus, well, when are you coming back? You know, what's going to be the sign that you're coming back? And he said, nobody knows. Only the Father. But he says, here's what you do about it. You stay awake. You're always ready. You live like it could be at any moment. So I think Peter meant the same thing. And I went through that whole thing at the beginning this morning saying, I may be going out on a limb here. I don't feel like I am. But I may be because I couldn't find anybody in the commentaries that agreed with me. I couldn't find a single one. And so okay, that was kind of almost a little disclaimer going, if you disagree with me, you may have good reason. You know? But I felt like I was looking at it the right way. So anyway, but because the lens that I was looking at it through was this discourse that takes place in Matthew 24, I thought, this is a great opportunity to talk about that chapter, because that's a tough chapter. A couple of you told me, you said, yeah, I went and reread it this afternoon and go, woo, that's tough. Yeah, it is. It's tough. And I'll tell you, you read 10 different commentaries, you're going to read 10 different interpretations about what it means. And so I thought, well, let's just talk about it. Because I think, again, if you look at the broader context, and here's another key of interpretation. You guys know I harp on context all the time, okay? But here's another interpreting tool. Look for clues in the text itself that help with interpretation. We're going to have a big one tonight, okay? That at least helps us with the timing of what he's talking about, okay? So, anyway, that's where we're going to look at tonight. So we're going to start actually in chapter 23. I'm not going to go through all of 23. I'm not even going to go through most of 23. I'm just going to go through a small part of it. But just the context, again, we need context. This is the last week of Jesus' life, okay? In the terms of the Gospel of Matthew, the triumphal entry was in 21, chapter 21, which marked his journey into Jerusalem at the beginning of the last week. Okay. And during that week, what does he do? He goes in and out of Jerusalem. Okay, he goes in and out of Jerusalem. And so in this, when we pick up in chapter 23, he and his disciples are in Jerusalem. Okay, and they're apparently within close proximity of the temple. And I just realized got a few slides I'm going to show in just a bit. But they're in close proximity of the temple. Okay, because this is the last week of Jesus' life, he is very public and vocal about how he feels about the hypocrisy of the Pharisees. Now, he has been speaking against them for at least a year, but smaller groups, right? Smaller groups. But we get to chapter 23, it's like, let me just give you all of it here at once, okay? And if you look at, you know, in your Bibles, you may have titles like at the beginning of chapter 20, like the seven woes of the Pharisees against the Pharisees. That's part of what's in chapter 23. But when you pick up in chapter 23, he's actually not into the seven woes yet. He's just talking about how the Pharisees they're not consistent with, you know, he says they occupy the seat of Moses and you should listen to what they preach, but don't look at what they do. Okay, again, that's before the seven woes, but he's already jumped in. He's talking about the Pharisees. Okay, so if you look on the handout, I'm just going to work my way through this. And again, most of the text that I'm going to cover is in here. Okay, that's the reason why it's four pages. I know some of you are like, four pages, Tim on four pages? It takes him an hour to get through one page. I understand. And if it gets out of time, we'll save some for next week. Okay, but I started to put all this in slides, and I thought, I'm going to kill you guys with slides if I do this all in slides. So I just did a handout. But the slides, I mean, the outline on the handout follows a pattern. So you've got the aberrations of the Pharisees, which is where the first 36 verses of chapter 3 includes the Pharisees' deviations, which I have in the outline. That includes... the Pharisees' deviations is where he's just speaking about their hypocrisy. Again, do not follow what they do, follow what they say. And then in verse 13, he jumps into what we know of as the seven woes. Woe unto you, woe unto you, woe unto you, okay? But I want to focus not on all seven, but just number seven, the last one, okay? Because many of these are about them, their hypocrisy. You know, he talks about, you're like what? Whitewashed tombs, you know, inside you're full of dead bones. But this last one, the last of the seven woes, which begins in verse 29, specifically talks about how the prophets of old were persecuted and killed. And it equates what happened, what the Jews did to the prophets of old, again, persecution, death, to what the Pharisees and their fellow Jews are doing right now to Jesus and to teachers who will follow him. Which, who were some of the primary teachers that followed him? The apostles, right? And that ultimately, retribution for what they are doing now and what will be done to his followers who come after him, retribution for that is going to happen to this generation of Pharisees. Okay? So, pick up in verse 29. He says, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you build the tombs of the prophets and decorate the monuments of the righteous, saying, 'If we had lived in the days of our fathers, we would not have taken part with them in shedding the blood of the prophets.' Thus you witness against yourselves that you are sons of those who murder the prophets. Fill up then the measure of your fathers, you serpents, you brood of vipers. How are you to escape being sentenced to hell? Therefore I send you prophets and wise men and scribes, some of whom you will kill and crucify. Some you will flog in your synagogues and persecute from town to town, so that on you may come all the righteous blood shed on earth, from the blood of innocent Abel to the blood of Zechariah the son of Berechiah, whom you murdered between the sanctuary and the altar. Truly I say to you, all these things will come upon this generation." Again, to summarize, he's saying what you have done or will do, what you are doing and what you will do to my followers who are teaching my message is going to come, the blood of their, that's going to be spilled for them, sorry, their blood that's going to be spilled is going to come upon this generation. Okay, so you with me? We call that a prophecy, right? It's coming upon this generation. Okay, now, as a follow-up to that, in verse 37, we have this section that I have labeled the abandonment of Jerusalem. Okay, and this goes hand in hand with their blood is going to be on your head, this generation. Okay, this goes hand in hand, and he says here, your house is going to be left desolate. Okay, look at verse 37. He says, "O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the city that kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to it." Again, does that not tie in directly with what he was just saying? He says, you like to decorate the tombs of the prophets as though you would not have been doing the same thing that those who persecuted them did. But let me tell you, you're doing the same thing to the prophets and the teachers of this generation, and so their blood's going to be on your head. So he says, "Hey, the city that kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to it, how often would I have gathered your children together as hen gathers her brood under her wings, and you would not. See, your house is left to you desolate." Now, who's he talking to? Jerusalem, the city, right? He's saying Jerusalem is going to be left desolate, okay? Jerusalem was the capital established by David when he overtook it. We studied that in 2 Samuel, right? It's his capital. It was where the temple was built by David's son Solomon on Mount Moriah, okay? Which the mount that was built by Herod the Great, still there today. We'll show you a picture of that in just a minute. This was the heart of Israel, was Jerusalem. And he tells them, it's going to be left desolate. Okay? So this is part of how the blood of the teachers of Jesus is going to come upon their head. Your city, your prized city, the home of the temple, is going to be left desolate. Okay? It's going to be left desolate. "I tell you, you will not see me again until you say, 'Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord.'" Okay? So, we got some predictions there at the end of chapter 23. That the blood of the righteous teachers that you are persecuting and will kill is going to be on your heads. This generation. I don't want you to lose that. He says, this generation. And following on that, speaking about Jerusalem and how they have, For their entire existence, they have persecuted the prophets. You're going to be left desolate. Your house is going to be left desolate. Okay? That's the context of all of this. And then when you pick up in chapter 24, I've called this first section correcting their abstraction. And the "there" in that sentence are the apostles, the disciples. Because apparently, either they didn't hear what Jesus said to Jerusalem and to the Pharisees, or they didn't understand. It's hard to know, but one or the other is the case. Okay? They either didn't hear it or didn't understand it. Because the first thing it says is in verse 1 of chapter 24, Jesus left the temple, which tells me again he was in proximity to the temple, and was going away when his disciples came to point out to him the buildings of the temple. But he answered, "You see all of these, do you not? Truly I say to you, there will not be left one stone upon another that will not be thrown down." So again, let me try to give you the Tim Agee version of this. The apostles, the disciples, are there oohing and awing about the majesty of the temple. And let me tell you, it would have been majestic. The temple as it stood there during the time of Jesus was built by Herod the Great. Now, it's still referred to. I had this question probably 2 years ago that I had never gotten an answer for. And finally I said, I'm going to figure out what this means. Because I'd been to Israel twice. And the Jews referred to the temple as it existed during the time of Jesus as the second temple period. And I was confused because to me, that would be the third temple, right? Because you got the first temple built by Solomon. And then you have the rebuilt temple during the time of Ezra and Nehemiah, right? David spent a while going through Ezra and Nehemiah, right? And then you have the temple built by Herod the Great during probably in the latter part of the BCs, leading up into the 80s as we know them, intended to be his showpiece. Now, Herod the Great was a great builder, and he wanted Jerusalem to be his showpiece. And so he built the Fortress Antonia, he built the Temple Mount, he built the temple. So I was like, why do they call that the Second Temple period? Well, they called it the Second Temple period because Herod the Great allowed the priest to continue temple worship in that spot while it was being built. And so to the Jews, it didn't change. It was still the temple. And so they did not consider it, since it was not destroyed, and since worship did not cease in that spot, they built around the priest as they were continuing to worship. They continued to call it the second temple. Okay? Even though it had to have looked completely different, other than having a holy place and a most holy place, than what it looked like before Herod the Great rebuilt it. Okay. But there's a little bit of the mount left today. And the stones that are from the period of the first century that Herod would have placed there are monstrous. They're monstrous. And so here's what's happening. The disciples are, as they're walking past the temple, when it says that they go, they said, they came to point to him the buildings of the temple. What does that mean? They're in awe of the construction. They're like, "Jesus, teacher, look at this thing. Isn't this incredible? Isn't this unbelievable?" And what does Jesus say? He's like, "Didn't you just hear me? I just said this whole place is going to be left desolate." And so to double down on that, what does he say? "You see the stones that make up the temple? There's not going to be one left on the other." And then, right after that, they all leave and they go to the Mount of Olives. Okay, now that's not a very far, it was not a far journey. It's right there, okay? And I want to show you real quick, I have three slides, okay? I have three slides. So, this is a view, modern times, standing on the peak of the Mount of Olives, looking down at the city of Jerusalem, okay? And this is one of my favorite places, just not because of what it looks like. It's full of tombs. This is the largest and the most exclusive Jewish cemetery in the world. It's full of tombs. It's not beautiful to look at. Back in the time of Jesus, it was probably full of olive trees, but no longer. But it's one of my favorite places to be because I know what happened in that place. And this is one of those things. You know, some of the other things that happened was we talked about the triumphal entry. Jesus rode into Jerusalem on a donkey right over this hill. So this is the direction he was riding into Jerusalem over the Mount of Olives. This was also where we talked about the Garden of Gethsemane, where Jesus prayed the prayer of agony. That took place where? On the Mount of Olives in the Garden of Gethsemane. And also where Jesus ascended into heaven. Where was he? He was on the Mount of Olives. And I remember the last time we were there, my family was with me. I grabbed my girls and I put my arms around them and I said, "I want you to think about," I said, "I don't believe in the concept of a holy place. Ever since the burning bush, I don't think there is such a thing as a holy place, right? Other than, I mean, under the new law, I should say. I mean, clearly there was the Holy of Holies where the Spirit of God resided. But in modern times, I don't believe in the concept of a holy place, okay? Jesus told the woman at the well that God does not reside in temples made with hands. That's the new covenant. Anyway, I said I don't believe in the concept of a holy place, but I want you to think about what happened here. And this discourse that happens in chapter 24 and in chapter 25, all of that happened while they were sitting on the Mount of Olives. Now, this is what it looks like today. This is what a team of archaeologists and artists think it looked like during the time of Jesus, or actually just after the time of Jesus. And this would be the perspective from standing on the Mount of Olives, overlooking the city of Jerusalem. So today, you still have part of the Mount of the Temple here. This is actually a wall that was built in the 15th century. So it was funny, one night we were walking around the out. I made a big deal about that wall is not from the time of Jesus. It's not from the time of Jesus. It was built by the Turks. And later on, we were walking around, just my family, we were walking around the wall at night. And Sarah made the comment about the walls not being very old. And I said, well, it's relative. Those walls are older than our country. They're not Bible old, but they're older than our country. But that's not a first century wall, okay? But right here you have the Dome of the Rock. Over here you have the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which the two of those together comprise the third most holy spot in Islam. But they are sitting on top of the remnants of what's left over of the Temple Mount built by Herod the Great. Okay? And again, archaeologists and artists went together to build this model. And this is what they believe the Temple Mount and the temple looked like during the time of Jesus. Okay? A magnificent structure. Okay? A magnificent structure. But in AD 70, what happened? In AD 70, the culmination of years of Jewish revolt, the Romans burned Jerusalem to the ground. They burned Jerusalem to the ground. And what did Jesus say? There won't be one stone left upon the other. There are no remnants left of the temple still standing. There's pieces of the western wall of the Temple Mount that are still standing. But the temple, there's no piece of the temple that's still there. Where is it? If you go down far enough into what's left of the existing wall, again, this part of this is original Herod the Great rock here, in the Temple Mount. Here's the burned stones that are piled up at the bottom of that wall, that for years and years and years were covered with dirt until archaeologists uncovered it. What was that? That was the temple. That's the temple. That's what happened, right? History tells us it happened. There's actually other archaeology not related to the temple where you can go underground in Jerusalem today and see evidence of houses that were burned to the ground, where they still have charred pieces of wood burned to the ground. So Jesus says, there's not going to be one stone left upon the other. There's not going to be one stone left on the other. So he corrects their mistake, their abstraction, their misunderstanding. And so that leads them to asking two questions. Now, Jeff this morning said, do you think they knew they were asking two questions? I don't know if they knew what they were asking at all. I mean, really, I don't know. But they do ask two questions. They may not have been expecting two answers. They may have thought this was all tied together. And they probably didn't even understand exactly what they were asking, whether it was one question or two questions. And I don't blame them. I mean, Jesus had already predicted his death twice, I think, at this point. And he was their leader. And any thought of him leaving would lead them to be what? Very apprehensive, right? And so, but here's the questions. And I've called this section calming their apprehensions because what he's going to start telling them is going to, what he's already been telling them that this building that you're marveling at, there's not going to be one stone left upon the other. I mean, like, whoa, wait a minute. What are you talking about? So some of this is about calming their apprehensions about what's coming. Okay? But they ask two questions. And here's the questions. Verse 3, as he sat on the Mount of Olives, again, this is often referred to as the Olivet Discourse because he was sitting on the Mount of Olives. The disciples came to him privately saying, "Tell us, when will these things be?" That's question number one, okay? For those playing at home, this is question one, okay? When will these things be? What things? The things that the blood of the martyrs is going to come upon the heads of those, the Pharisees of this generation. That the house of Jerusalem is going to be left desolate. That there's not going to be one stone left upon the other. When is that going to happen? That's question number one. That's the way Jesus answers it anyway. Here, question number two is, what will be the sign of your coming and the close of the age? Question two. So you have a when and a what. Okay. And again, to Jeff talking to me this morning, to them that might have all been one thing. They thought, well, this is all, that's when you're going to come back. You're going to come back when all this is destroyed. It's all going to happen at the same time. I don't know what they were thinking. I don't. But I know how Jesus answered. Okay. Now, picking up in verse 4, going all the way through the rest of the chapter, again, if you pull 10 commentaries off the shelf and you read them, you get 10 different interpretations. But I believe that Jesus answers these questions separately. I believe that the answer to the when question begins in verse 4 and goes through verse 35. And I believe the answer to the what question begins in verse 36 and doesn't conclude till the end of chapter 25. Okay, you with me? I want to tell you why I believe that. And here's one of those things, like, we talk about context is a big deal, but there's also a big deal when you look within the text itself for markers that help us interpret. Okay? Go down to verse 35. Okay? If you just have the handout, flip a couple pages and you'll get down to verse 35. Okay? Verse 35. The last part. Actually, 34. Go to 34. He says, now, he's been telling a bunch of stuff we're going to cover in just a minute. Okay? I'm going to go through it pretty quickly. But at the end of this answer, which comes from verse 4 to verse 33, he says, "Truly I say to you, this generation..." Now, he had just said to the Pharisees, the blood of all those who come after me is going to be on the head of those of this generation. And here again he says, "Truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place." So what does that tell me? That what he's saying from verse 4 through verse 33 is going to happen to the people who are alive right now. Right? The very next thing he says in verse 36 is, concerning that day, no one knows. So he's talking about two different things. Right? Because what concludes in verse 34 is, it's going to happen to this generation. The next thing he answers, he says, no one knows when it's going to happen, only the Father. So he's talking about two things. That's a timestamp. We don't get a lot of timestamps in Scripture. And so when you got them, you grab them and you hold on to them. They're prized possessions. Okay? It's going to happen to this generation. Okay? What happened in this generation that left Jerusalem desolate, that caused not one stone to be left up on top of each other in the temple? It was the destruction of Jerusalem by the Romans in AD 70. And so I think all of this up to verse 35 is a prediction about what's going to happen to the city of Jerusalem. And not just a prediction, instructions on what to do about it. Okay? So follow along with me. I talk about following the bouncing ball. This is a follow the bouncing ball moment. Okay? So, let's pick up in verse 4. Okay? What are the signs going to be that this thing is coming? Okay? Well, he says, first of all, in verses 4 and 5, there are going to be those who attempt to deceive you leading up to this event. Okay? Part of this, the reason why I've called this calming their apprehension is because part of the message is this is not going to happen for a little while. Okay? If we assume that Jesus was 33 when he died, then this happened 37 years later. But the problem with that is we don't know what year Jesus was born in. Because remember, we had that whole question, unsolved mysteries thing You know, B.C. and A.D., it wasn't like the day Jesus was born, they went into the international time clock and flipped a big switch and everybody switched over from B.C. to A.D. Didn't work like that, okay? So we don't know exactly what year it was that Jesus died either. But we know Jerusalem was destroyed in A.D. 70. So, but it's no less than 37 years, maybe up to 40 years, between this prediction and when it actually happens, okay? Now, so he says, what's going to happen? There's going to be those who attempt to deceive. Look at verse 4. Jesus answered them, "See that no one leads you astray. For many will come in my name, saying, 'I am the Christ,' and they will lead many astray." So during this time period, while you're waiting for the house to be left desolate, there's going to be those who attempt to deceive, who come pretending to be me. Okay? Now, I've got a little note in your handout. Josephus, great Jewish historian who wrote for the Romans, okay, he records in his book, The War of the Jews, two movements that were led by those who claimed to be messiahs. One of those, the Sicarii movement. I'm fairly familiar with the Sicarii movement because the Sicarii were a group of Jews who rebelled against the Romans, who also made their last stand at Masada. If you remember talking about Masada, which is up on a mesa, a magnificent palace built by Herod the Great, that when Herod died, his sons left it in disrepair. The Sicarii, who were scimitar-wielding Jews, who believed that they had a Messiah in their midst, and they all died on top of Masada. It's kind of the last stand of the Jewish revolt. The Sicarii, and then I've got Menahem and Simon by Gioria, who were listed as those who, again, were messianic movements. Okay, so there's evidence from history that during this time period, there were those who came pretending to be the Messiah. Okay? Then he's going to say, there's going to be things that are going to disturb you during this time period. There's going to be things that are going to happen that are going to disturb you. The first thing is, there's going to be wars and there's going to be rumors of wars. The war doesn't happen till 87. You're not going to be, the Jerusalem is not going to be destroyed by 87. But in the interim, there's going to be wars and rumors of wars. Okay? And so you pick up in verse 6, and he says, "You will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not alarmed, for this must take place, but the end is not yet." Okay? The Jewish revolt began in the 40s, AD 40s. Okay? One of the first places it began was in Caesarea Maritima. But it spread out all over Palestine. Okay? There were wars taking place all around between the Jews and the Romans. Then at verse 7, he says there will be natural disasters. Okay, look at verse 7. "For nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom. There will be famines and earthquakes in various places." Okay, and he says all these are but the beginning of the birth pains. Now, we know one example when Agabus, the prophet in the book of Acts, I've got that in your handout, chapter 11. Agabus prophesied that there would be a famine in Jerusalem. And there was. That's the reason why Paul, on his last missionary journey, collected funds from all over his church, the churches he had planted, to take back to help those in Jerusalem. So there were famines, okay? "There will be persecution." Look at verse 9. "They will deliver you up to tribulation, put you to death, and you will be hated by all nations for my name's sake. Many will fall away and betray one another and hate one another." Is there evidence in the New Testament of persecution of the disciples taking place during that time period? Absolutely. Just read the book of Acts. It's full of persecution. Okay. Verse 11, "There will be a rise in the number of false prophets." Look at verse 11. "Many false prophets will arise and lead many astray." And then verse 12, "There will be lawlessness. Because lawlessness will be increased, the love of many will grow cold. But the one who endures to the end will be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom will be proclaimed throughout the whole world as a testimony to all nations, and then the end will come." Did the gospel get transmitted to the entire known world? Yes, absolutely. Now, we pick up in verse 15, and this is where it gets kind of hairy, okay? We're reading going, what are you talking about? Okay? Just follow with me. I think if we break it down, it'll make sense, okay? I forgot to mention the parallel passages to this, Mark 13 and Luke 21, none as extensive as this, but it can give us some insight into what's happening, okay? The next thing I have labeled as coaching them for the Roman assault. Now, ultimately, what's the fulfillment of this? The Romans destroying Jerusalem, okay? The Romans destroyed Jerusalem in AD 70. They burn it to the ground, okay? So the first thing that happens is in verse 15, he defines the destroyer. Now, who's the destroyer? It's the Roman Empire. But he's going to define who it is. Okay, who is he talking about? Well, here's one of the complicating factors. Verse 15. So when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by the prophet Daniel standing in the holy place, let the reader understand. You're like, what? What's he talking about? Okay, now, Matthew is writing to a Jewish audience. Mark, one of the parallel accounts, is writing to a Jewish audience. He also refers to the abomination of desolation. Now, the abomination of desolation was mentioned by Daniel. As part of a prophecy about a future attack by Antiochus Epiphanes. Okay, back in the third century BC. Okay, referred to this future attack as the abomination of desolation. So Jesus is using the language of the prophet Daniel in talking about this invading army. Now, how do we know that this is not exclusively meaning that the same army that Daniel was talking about is the same one that's going to attack here, or the same entity, this abomination of desolation? Because Luke records this same thing as surrounded by armies. Luke was writing to Gentiles. If Luke was writing to Gentiles and referred to the abomination of desolation, the Gentiles would go, wait a minute, we don't have any idea what that means, right? But who knew the prophecies of Daniel? Jews. So Jesus used language that the Jews would understand, the abomination of desolation. There's an army that's going to take over Jerusalem. So don't get, you know, a lot of folks will say, hey, this is one of the signs of the coming apocalypse, of Armageddon, that you're going to have this abomination. No, 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 no. He's just talking about there's going to be an army that surrounds the city of Jerusalem. Okay? On Sunday morning, I know in the teen class, they've been covering a book about end times. And they had a whole chapter on this. I loved it because Sarah said, this was a good lesson for me to miss because I already know that. I love that. It's like, wow, that's awesome. I hope I'm not that cocky, but I love that. So I don't think there's anything magical about the abomination of desolation. I don't think that's some mythical beast that's going to show up, you know, when the seventh seal is opened. I think it just means there's an army. There's an army that's approaching Jerusalem, okay? And then here's the instructions to divert them from danger. Okay, you have an approaching army. Okay, when the army comes, here's how those in and around Jerusalem are to react to the attack. Okay, and it's practical. Okay, verse 16, let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. So he says, if you're in Judea and you're not in Jerusalem, don't come into the city. Do what? Go flee to the mountains. Harder to find you in the mountains, right? Harder to attack you when you're in the mountains. So he says, go flee to the mountains, okay? Verse 17, let the one who is on the housetop not go down to take what is in his house. What's that? What's he saying? He says, if you're up on top of your house, escape the city via rooftop. Don't come back down, try to collect all your belongings, and then get out of town. It's probably going to be too late. Stay up on the roof, and get out by rooftop, okay? Verse 18, sorry, I lost my place here. Verse 18, let the one who is in the field not turn back to take his cloak. He says, if you're in the field, again, you're outside the city, don't come into the city to get your cloak. Leave. Okay, if you're in the field, stay outside the city. Okay? And then, verse 19, alas for women who are pregnant and for those who are nursing infants in those days, pray that your flight may not be in winter or on a Sabbath. Now, in winter, there's really only two seasons in Israel. There's a rainy season and a dry season. And the winter is the rainy season. It rains, and it rains a lot. Okay? What's harder to move around in? Rain. Okay? Especially if you are pregnant and you are nursing a child, or you're nursing a child, right? Much harder to travel. So it says pray that it's not during one of those times, okay? Or on a Sabbath when you're restricted from how far you can go, okay? Flip the pages. All right, where did I get to? That's verses 19 through 21. Did I read all the way through there? Yeah, then verse 22, he says, do not look for a false savior. 22, if those days had not been cut short, no human being would be saved. But for the sake of the elect, would be cut short. Then if anyone asks you, look, here is the Christ, so there he is, do not believe it. Okay, don't believe it. And he says, for false Christs and false prophets will arise and perform great signs and wonders, and so as to lead many astray, if possible, even the elect. See, I have told you beforehand. So if they say to you, look, he is in the wilderness, do not go out. If they say, look, he is in the inner rooms, do not believe it. For as the lightning comes from the east and shines as far as the west, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. The first allusion to what he's going to answer later. Wherever the corpse is, there the vultures will gather. Immediately, this is in verse 29, immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, and the moon will not give us light, and the stars will fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Now, I want to stop there for a second. This is another one of those that trips people up, because they're like, okay, well, this is describing some mystical event. This is very consistent with the language of the Old Testament describing battles, wars. And I've got in your handout, if you look under describing the denouement, there's a handful of references about, you know, in the fall of cities like Babylon and territories like Edom and Egypt. Isaiah 13, Isaiah 34, Ezekiel 31, that describe the fall of those places in the same kinds of terms as the darkening of the sun and the moon, the falling of stars. You know, if you have stars in the sky that are obscured by smoke, it's like they're falling out of the sky, right? They're disappearing, okay? The shaking of the heavens. You know, in war, you know, you've got a lot of stuff happening. And so there are, you know, can the sun be darkened, the moon darkened? Can the stars be darkened? Yes, this is not, again, talking about some supernatural event that's going to take place. It's just talking about war. I mean, they burned the city of Jerusalem to the ground. Don't you think that those who were in the middle of that felt like they were in the middle of some type of supernatural event? That everything was darkened? That everything that they had known for their entire lives was suddenly gone? And so it should not surprise us that these types of phrases are used. The tribulation, sun will be darkened, moon will be not give us light, stars will fall from heaven, powers from heaven of heaven will be shaken. Okay? Now, here's another one that cheers people up. Then will appear in heaven the sign of the Son of Man. Then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he will send out his angels with a loud trumpet call, and they will gather his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. And you go, okay, Tim, you're wrong. You're wrong. He's talking about the second coming. That's what he's talking about. But what's the problem with that? The problem with that is, right after that, he says, all these things will happen when? To this generation. So how could the destruction of Jerusalem, and I know I'm running out of time, how could the destruction of Jerusalem be a sign of the coming of the Son of Man? I look at it this way. It's a sign that what God says is going to happen will happen. And so if God said that Jerusalem was going to be destroyed through Jesus told the disciples that Jerusalem is going to be destroyed, it's going to be burned to the ground, you can be sure that if God says his Son is going to come back and gather up the elect, he's going to come back and gather up the elect. You with me? Because we have to, you cannot ignore that what comes in the very next part of this is when he confirms the announcement is that he says, hey, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. So somehow the destruction of Jerusalem has to be the sign of the coming of the Son of Man. And I think it's a sign that God is going to fulfill what he says he's going to do. If God says it, bank on it. It's going to happen. So you see that he predicted that Jerusalem was going to be destroyed. It happened. You see that Jesus said, I'm coming back in the same way that I left. You can bank on it. He's coming back. Okay? Now, I'm going to skip down to verse 36. And we covered most of this morning, so I'm going to kind of end here. But this is where he says in verse 36, but concerning that day. Now, I think here he's switching to answer question two. Again, the disciples may not have known they were asking two questions. But clearly it's a second answer because he had just said, everything I've already said is not going to happen. It's going to happen before this generation passes away. And the very next thing he says is, concerning that day and hour, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven nor the Son, but the Father only. And so I think that's the answer to the second question. What's going to be the sign of your coming in the end of the age? And Jesus says, I can tell you when this abomination of desolation is going to come upon the city of Jerusalem. It's going to happen within this generation. But as far as when I'm coming back, nobody knows. Nobody knows. But what's more important is not that answer, but what he says you do about it. What do you do with that information that you don't know when he's coming back? And he says, stay awake. Stay awake. And that's what this whole lesson this morning was. You stay awake. And how does he answer that? He spends a chapter and a half answering it. He gives two analogies and three parables. A very small parable about a master who went away and had two servants, one who was faithful and prepared and one who went out into debauchery. And he found one faithful, one not faithful, which is kind of like a little snippet of the parable of the talents. And then you got the parable of the wise and foolish virgins, one group prepared, one group not prepared. And then you got the talents, which is way more detailed, right? About what God means, what Jesus meant when he said, stay awake. Okay? You look at the beginning of all of those parables, especially look at the talents, he says, at that time, when it begins. What time, Jesus? When he comes back. When he comes back. If you don't understand the context of that, you can't get the full meaning of the parable of the talents. And then chapter 25 ends with the separating of the sheep and the goats. When's that going to happen? It's going to happen when he returns. So he spends all that time answering that. But it's two questions that he answers separately. How do I know they're separate? Because he says all those things are going to happen to this generation. So we have to understand it within that, the context of that verse. That it all happened to that generation, right? It all happened to that generation. And we know, again, you can look right here and see, that's what's left of the temple. The stones are all piled up, okay? They're not the way they were built. They're all piled up, okay? It came to pass, which also means what? Jesus is coming back, but we don't know when. And so that's why I believe when Peter says the end of all things is at hand, he wasn't saying, I know for certain that Jesus is coming next week. No, he's saying, Jesus told me I have to always be ready for the end. And so what am I telling you? Always be ready for the end. Right? So I look at it through the lens of what Peter learned from Jesus. And that's how I interpret it. That's how I interpret it. So I thought, hopefully, I know we went over. Hopefully it was beneficial to go through that. And hopefully it can bring a little clarity to what can be a very confusing passage. But because he's coming back, we know that those who are going to be able to live forever with him are those who have followed him, who have been faithful to him. As Peter said, you've got to take this seriously. Live out your love for one another. Use the gifts that you have. Use the gifts that you have. And so that's what our instruction is to do every day. And I hope that was a useful reminder. If there's anything that you need, if there's anything we can do for you, please come while Sam leads us in our invitation.